Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are an animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Ian McEwan. He's the author, most recently, of Amsterdam, which was the winner of the 1998 Booker Prize. The author, too, among others, in reverse order, of Enduring Love, Black Dogs, The Innocent, The Child in Time, The Comfort of Strangers, The Cement Garden, and two books of short stories, First Love, Last Rites, and In Between the Sheets. Now, although this book involves a mutual suicide pact and many other sinister curves, I wanted to begin by asking you, it features a composer who feels that beauty has been lost in the world of classical music to the avant-garde and to atonality, to late Schoenberg. And I noticed in him a trace of the author, Ian McEwan, whose work seems to me to have arrived at a time when fiction itself was doing complex, formal, atonal things, and who brought back to it the thriller and plots that would quicken the pulse at the same time as their point of view chilled the mind. And I wondered about that.
You can never get back. What's the point? You can only do this through a screen of self-consciousness. I mean, there's no way out of modernity in that way. So, I've always held great faith in the power of story and the attractiveness of the story. But you can't tell a story now in the way perhaps you could tell it in the early 19th century. You have to. Its own process also is part of the story. And Amsterdam, although it's in a sense a rather Edwardian kind of tale, self-consciously opens up its innards. I mean, it's when I was writing it, I thought of it as a sort of little wristwatch. Mm-hmm. But it was a wristwatch with the back off. I mean, I wanted my ideal reader would be someone who takes pleasure not only in the tale but in the unfolding of the tale. Mine is a very classical spirit. I like precision, restraint, elegance, economy. I distrust the outpouring. If I have imagery, I use it sparingly. And I wanted to ally this to a kind of chaotic or frightening subject matter.
Recently, Tom Stoppard told me that although the parameters of his work are carefully laid out, that details, the next page, the next move, take him by surprise. Similarly, your work seems to be, because of its almost, as you say, switch watch mechanisms and their careful working outs, to be elaborately planned. But I suspect you too are surprised from day to day by the turn of events.
I define a good day's writing by the extent to which it surprises me. I mean, there is no great pleasure in simply fulfilling, you know, a master plan. And I've always wondered at Flaubert's writing of Madame Bovary, where every paragraph was mapped. And I saw in the Morgan Library in New York Henry James' proposal for a novel, which ran to 110 closely typed pages in itself. I mean, it was already reading to me like a James novel, even denser than a late James novel.
Even those of us who haven't seen those, who've seen the prefaces, know that.
Yes. Amazingly, it was turned down, too. So you've got the refusal note there. Yes, I mean, surprise is crucial to composition. I have a rough map. It varies, but I'm an approximate map of where I want to be. I do think carefully in terms of structure. I mean, for example, Amsterdam I always knew was going to be five acts. It had a kind of hourglass shape in my mind of two characters making a pact, falling out and arriving in that city to perform a kind of mutual euthanasia. But everything else along the way was really generated by the sentence. And it's the sentence that often makes a character. I didn't know till I got to it that I was going to have a foreign secretary. I didn't realize the extent to which I was going to get involved in getting into the mind of a composer. I went along to a newspaper conference to see if there was anything in it for me, and came away thinking, well, perhaps. At least I know now how a morning conference works. But it was only when I began to write it that I found out all the other minor characters in the novel. So you have to have a mixture of two things. You've got to have a fairly good idea of where you're going. You've got to have lots of unspoken, vague urgencies. It's the only way I can really put it. Lay yourself open to generating the kind of thing that make you feel at the end of, you know, your day, your 750 words or whatever it is, that you've put something together that wasn't there before. That, for me, is writing pleasure.
And the backgrounds of the books as they are being prepared, it seems to me that Enduring Love, at least, which has as its protagonist and narrator a science writer, that there's a good deal of what seems like pleasure reading that went into his making The Marvelous Naturalist, Wilson, Edward O. Wilson. Do I have the name right? Edward, yes.
Yes, Edward.
And books on Descartes and probability theory and this kind of thing. At what point do the things you're reading coalesce into a character and then perhaps into a novel?
Well, in the case of Enduring Love, this really was pleasure reading. It's the stuff that came out of my own curiosity and had been gathering for years and years. I'd been reading widely in the biological sciences. I realized I'd got as far as I ever was going to get with quantum mechanics. I knew that I was never going to understand it. And I was interested in the way in which a certain section of science, in the biological sciences, were rife now with speculation about things like human nature, consciousness, but especially human nature, that traditionally are the novelist's patch. Here were scientists straying onto our territory. And I read for years in that, but I certainly had no idea I was going to get a novel out of it. I mean, it wasn't that kind of reading.
Now, there again, as with the composer in Amsterdam, the newest book, the hero, a science writer, kind of regrets and resents that he is not in the pure sciences, but he is rather just a journalist, as the composer here, Clive, is proud that he is named with Paul McCartney, but at the same time has envies of the people whose works are taken formidably seriously. Does this characteristic afflict you as well? Is there some kind of novel you feel you should be writing?
No. No, I think one has to resist such a notion. I think you've just got to write the novel you know you have to write. No, if I was writing the novel I should be writing, I would have been writing by the tone of my... I mean, if I listened to my critics when I published my first short stories, I would have retreated into that, you know, rather dull, well-modulated accounts of social mobility and broken marriage that used to characterize British fiction, in the sort of 20 years after the war. No, you have to just press on. Clive, in fact, is an eminent composer who's actually no good. And it's interesting to for me, and I don't think I've said my last on this yet, what it's like to be an artist in one's 50s, 60s, and beginning to wonder if you're any good at all. And yet all around you are people who have a vested interest in the idea that you are, your publishers or your audiences or your the person who arranges your recording contracts. No one is going to tell you. They were happy to tell you perhaps when you were 23. But there are too many people now on board. So I think there's more comedy to be had out of this.
Now, I'm very interested, and please pardon me if this is a presumptuous question, but I guess the reason why I've always been curious about these artists who are comparing themselves to another was that after I read The Cement Garden, I happened to see a movie called Our Mother's House.
Oh, yeah.
And to read a novel by Julian Gloag, which virtually has an identical plot to The Cement Garden. And I wondered about the relation between the two, if any.
I didn't know Julian Gloag's novel, but when The Cement Garden came out, I was very upset to discover that that here was this book published 17 years before with a vaguely similar plot, and with a much more religious running metaphor throughout it. I suppose what was upsetting was in the rather kind of harsh environment of British, of London literary politics, the word plagiarism was used, which could have incensed.
Oh, that I didn't.
Which really did make me cross. And there are one or two critics who will trot this out every now and then, and I think it was just a nonsense. I, in fact, still have a fading yellow cutting from a German newspaper describing three children who were being looked after by their mother. And when she died, they buried her in the cellar because they didn't want to be put into children's homes. And that cutting dates from about 2 years after I published my novel. In other words, I think this
it
must happen.
It happens from time to time.
I think it does happen.
Well, what was peculiar to me, I guess, was not so much the novel, which I didn't very much like, but that the film, which had Dirk Bogarde as the returning father.
No, I haven't seen the film.
It's quite amazing, and I think you would be amazed by it, mm-hmm. because it is played so low-key with such terrifying discretion that these children who murder their mother and then when father gets home, murder him. Mm. It's very tea time. It's very measured. It's very reasonable. And it's very Ian McEwan. I thought that the film had proleptically captured the quiet tones of menace that you refined in novel after novel, and that's why I it stayed in my mind.
Well, apparently Julian Gloag was convinced that I thoroughly ripped him off and went on to write another novel about a man who writes a novel. It languishes in obscurity, and then some young upstart comes along, rips him off, and wins a prize. I think it's even called The Prize. Somewhere, I think he lives over in Paris, is a very embittered person. All I can say is, there are certain plots that are just going to happen. I think children obscuring the fact their children, their parents are dead in order to stay together is something that's likely to be thought up a number of times, especially by reality. That's all I could say about it.
Which brings me to, the question of the thematic. What children do in order to hold a family together or indeed to tear a family apart is often at the heart of the stories and, in fact, the novels have an interest in etiology, in the derivation of adult behavior from childhood inceptions that's distinctly old Freudian. Mm. And I wondered about that.
I was very influenced by Freud. I read a great deal of Freud in my early 20s. I have to say I've rather changed my position on that. The more I read about Freud, about his life, about the manner of his work, the less of a scientist he appears. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we'll reinstate him as some kind of poet. But he seems to have been generally wrong about most things. Yet another story is coming up with the most appalling treatment of some of his patients. The behavior of a mad guru rather than that of a useful, helpful clinical scientist. Yet at the same time, he made something possible for me. I was very, very influenced by three essays on sexuality and the psychopathology of everyday life. And those stories were really animated by the spirit of Freud.
Mm. Well, I was struck, I guess, when I was reading Enduring Love. I think there's a moment in the infamous case of Dr. Krieber, is it? I may be forgetting the doctor's name, but he believed that he was, in fact, on Earth the wife of God, and that God had arranged for bathrooms to be occupied when the doctor needed to urinate as a form of retaliation for infidelity. Mm. And similarly, in Enduring Love, a woman believes that the King of England has arranged for there to be no rooms when she comes to visit him because he wants to discommode her.
The penetration of paranoid delusion into religious thinking is, I think, pretty well documented. I mean, every year in Jerusalem, for example, 200 or 300 people are scooped off the streets, convinced they're Jesus. And, you know, Bob Stone's written in that marvelous novel, The Jerusalem Gate, about the Jerusalem syndrome. It's a fascinating area of speculation. Those fringe areas between madness and sanity, or normative behavior, what you want to call it, can be occupied by people who can have very, very powerful effects on other people. And I mean, Enduring Love is partly about, you know, how the life of a rationalist can be completely destroyed when he finds that the tools of thought no longer, I mean, or the rules of thought no longer apply.
I'm speaking to Ian McEwan, the author most recently of Amsterdam, which won the 1998 Booker Prize. This is Michael Silverblatt on Bookworm. It brings me to Amsterdam itself because it struck me that if the boundaries between madness and sanity have often been of concern to you, here more than anywhere else that I know of, it seemed to be almost as if you were exploring the organizing principles of paranoia and setting them against the organized principles of farce, that somehow or other the intricacy with which the mind closes itself, in this case, I would guess that the ostensible subject is folie à deux, two men who share a suicide pact, a mutual euthanasia. But in secret, there's a different pathology underlying the entire novel, a kind of revenge and a usurpation of lives, a wiping out of history.
They fall out in a very serious way, and the novel is really a tragedy of, or even a comedy and a tragedy of perception. Its narrative style is one in which the reader always knows a little more than the characters, but nothing is ever pointed out. So one inhabits these two characters alternately. The reader is party to Vernon's, the newspaper editor's thoughts, and then to Clive's thoughts. the reader is meant to have a fairly strong sense of the limitation or the error in their perception, and yet at the same time be carried along by the certainty that each man has. Well, when two people fall out, one of the first things they have to do, and I think this is the fascination for me of a row, of disagreement, the past has to be rewritten, because you have to account for why this person was your friend in the first place, or why they were your husband or your wife. The love, the friendship has to be forgotten. Some kind of emotional state allows memory to be highly selective and to rearrange the past, or just pick out salient details, but different details, to maintain it's called confabulation. You have to give a good account of why you're behaving the way you are.
Mm-hmm.
This is right in the heart of novel writing, mm-hmm. too. So they overlap here. So the extent to which Vernon and Clive, as they spiral into thinking first each other is bad and then conveniently that the other is mad, is a process not unlike composing, if you like. Mm. They have to recreate each other.
Well, composing indeed, and it seems as if, like the wristwatch you mentioned at the beginning, the novel is constructed of mechanism within mechanism, and it seemed to me that at least no American critic has mentioned this, but the surrounding mechanism seems to be that of George Lane, a man married to Molly, who in this novel has had three lovers. By the end of the book, Molly is dead and all three lovers are in various ways dispensed with. So it would seem as if we're told on the first or second page that Molly has always been rather bad to George.
Yeah.
It seems as if George is physically Stalinizing the world. Molly gone and now three lovers and now no one to talk about the multiple infidelities that one seems to think plagued his life.
And now he can get on and have the very memorial service he'd always wanted for her. Without these ex-lovers sniggering,
yes.
Or exchanging glances. Absolutely. Although all George has to do is take the first step, which is sell photographs of the Foreign Secretary wearing a dress to Vernon. George cannot possibly foresee what will happen from that, but certainly he takes the first step in this. He wishes to destroy Garmany, there's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm. And it seems eventually destroy the editor as well. No?
As it turns out, I mean, it could have made Vernon, of course, but it suits George, of course, very well to have all these people disposed of one way or the other. But yes, he is a kind of deus ex machina, but only up to a point. George himself is ironized at the very end. I mean, he's made his fortune as a publisher with books like, you know, The Seventh Seal, the Holy Grail, Is Hitler Alive and Well in Peru? In other words, you know, he has leached a kind of credulousness. You know, the whole astrology world of which George doesn't believe in himself. And one of the churches he certainly doesn't want to go to will be filled with the very kind of people who buy his books. But finally, you know, the only place to stand, as it were, is between the lines. I'd hope the reader would find pleasure in always sensing a little more than the characters because of the ironies that surround their sort of hopeless compulsions to destroy each other or to remake the past.
Now, final question, and I guess it applies, as I said before, the child's role in bringing the family together or in breaking it up. It seems as if plot is a complex mechanism by which things decompose. And I wondered of the hurtling toward, if not tragedy, entropy and chaos and emotional dissolution. Is it in fact an inevitability or just in the sphere of these novels?
I think I've gone through a very long, slow, complicated change in this. I mean, the stories that make up First Love, Last Rites were written when I was 21 and 22. And there you'll find a reckless pessimism about human nature, one that made me laugh even as I was typing it. I felt a satanic irresponsibility. Now I'm 50 and I feel that kind of pessimism was the luxury of my youth. And I feel that with a real sense of mortality closing in, I'm looking around for those things that I can believe in. Not in a sort of craven sense that I'm desperate for religious deliverance, but those things in human nature that I can give some kind of credence to, and optimism of a fragile kind, because doesn't want to get sentimental about this. I mean, we are a very flawed species, but we are also capable of great acts of love and courage, kindness and selflessness. And the more I see of that, the more I feel I have a duty to also to describe that. And the nihilism of those early stories is not the whole picture. And it was a luxury. At the age of 22, you don't really think you're going to die. Intellectually, you know you must, but you don't feel you're going to die. And therefore, you can damn everyone and everything. It's a delight. It's clear the decks, you know, stand back.
But now?
You bring children into the world. You want the world to succeed in some way. You love someone. You want love, you know, to have a chance. And you have to find the balance between realism about human prospects and wanting success for the project of culture and civilization.
I've been speaking to Ian McEwan particularly about his most recent novel, Amsterdam, the winner of the 1998 Booker Prize and published under Nantelis's imprint at Doubleday. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard. Development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, what time?
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.